Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July the 20th, 1999, and in Creekside Room this morning is Diane Lagerquist's session called Bearing the Future of the Tree, Estiological Community, number 99-1. Let's listen in.
My name is Deanne Lagerquist. When I'm not here, I'm in most of the time in Northfield, Minnesota, where I teach at St. Olaf College.
Deanne.
And this week, I'm asked to teach under the broad heading of theme, namely the Tree of Life. So today I want to spend a little time just thinking about that theme, aside from the way it appears in Revelations 22, because I know a lot of you are going to the Bible study, and you're getting that, how it appears in the book of Revelation. But I think that part of the richness of that theme is that it's not only in Revelations 22, and in fact, part of the reason the Tree of Life image works in Revelation 22 is because it evokes a rich tradition throughout the whole of our scripture, and it also just conjures up lots of natural associations for us, as well as it connects with symbols outside the Bible and in other traditions. So I thought we might start this morning by each of you taking maybe 2 minutes to I'm not going to ask you what kind of tree would you like to be. We're not going to do that exercise. But rather to have you, have you think about memories you have of trees or a tree, or values you associate with trees, or meanings that trees have for you, and then we'll take a short time. I'll hear from a few of you about what does that image of a tree conjure up in you. Because that's how symbols work. They take what we already have and then move us towards something else. So let's think about trees. Just let your mind wander a little bit. And think about trees. Skills to look at your body language, see if you're ready for your salad, whether you're ready to share yet or not. With students, I can tell they put their pencils down and stuff. It's harder to tell with you. But let me start and say, tell you one of the things that has an association that I have with trees, having been at Holden and hiking with a small child. And nowadays, you get these instructions about taking children into the woods, and one of the things they tell you is, first of all, you give your child a whistle. And then, when Thomas was really little, we would play this game the whole hike, where he would run ahead, just out of sight, and then do the next thing you're supposed to do, which is stand by a tree. Because if you get lost in the forest, that's what a child is instructed to do. You find a tree, you stand by the tree, and you blow your whistle, and then people will find you, and you don't wander around, and you have shelter, and all of these things work together. So when I think of this Tree of Life, lots of associations with trees, but I come back to that one about a tree is where you go when you're lost. Stand there by that tree. How about others? Things that you associate with trees. Or a tree.
I have memories of two trees in our yard. One was a climbable tree, and I'd climb it, and there were three branches. You know, there was a milestone getting to each branch.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought of it as a refuge. When I climbed the tree, I'd climb up. Nobody could see me. I could observe. And it was just really a personal, it was like a person, you know, that tree. And then the other tree was a huge tree. an elm, and it was not climbable. It had no lower branches, right. I think on purpose. My dad probably trimmed them off. And it was huge, and it kind of hung over the house and hung over my bedroom window. And it was sort of beautiful and mysterious and inaccessible and scary in its form.
Yeah.
But it gave shade to the whole house, so it had a lot of benefits. And the winter was totally bare, so you could see through to the mountains. So it was just kind of a beautiful thing, but inaccessible. But it wasn't personal, something to be observed, but not
nice.
Compared to the front yard tree.
Yeah, that you could climb up in. And I think a very common childhood association with trees is that challenge of getting up and being able to be concealed. Yeah.
I was thinking about the variety of trees. Mm-hmm. Where we came from, there were palm trees, and then to come up here where they're just radically different, and that's one of the great things too.
Yeah. Indeed, many different kinds of trees, and the difference between a palm tree and any other is astonishing. And yet probably if we think about the landscape of the Near East, palm tree is probably one of the ones that's there. Those of us who live in the upper Midwest, you probably don't have a palm tree in your in your yard. Yeah. Not if you had elms.
Right, and I could climb the tree of heaven.
Yeah.
That was the
Dan.
Well, I grew up in a yard that did have palm trees, but actually I was chuckling, Dan, because of the first word association that I thought of was salad. And then you said to us,
salad?
Well, I'll explain it. Then you said to us, I don't know whether you're ready for your salad. And I thought, how did you know I was thinking about salads? Because I grew up with a huge avocado tree.
Oh, yeah.
And so one of my earliest memories was we always had avocados in our salads. And it was very strange to go away then from Southern California and not have that. But what it made me think about was the revelation image, because my dad, starting 40 years ago, would landscape our yard with fruit trees.
Yeah.
So we have kumquat trees and grapefruit trees and oranges and limes and quinces and this big avocado tree. So we have fruit year round. And so when he talks about the fruits of the tree of life, it's a powerful image for me.
So there's not just the security and shelter that you get from a tree, but a tree can also nourish you and provide food.
And the other image, which you have alluded to, the elm, but ours is a little different. We have all this, it's called a monkey puzzle tree. I don't know if any of you know it. It's a southern hemisphere form of pine that has very thorny kind of branches. So it's really when you walk on it, you get your feet cut and everything. And I think it got its name from, they said it would be a real puzzle for a monkey to be in that tree. But so it was unclimbable. But what it was the birds all hung out there because cats couldn't get up there either. So we had owls and birds and everything in this tree.
So trees are something we share with other creatures. Yeah.
I have lots of memories of trees, like Christmas trees and trees from my childhood. I just wrote my memoirs, the first 10 years of my life, and trees enter in. But looking through my whole life, I think I'm most awed by the sequoias in Yosemite and the Sequoia National Park. You feel the greatness of God, let's say, and the insignificance of people.
Yeah.
And that sense of history, that some of those were there maybe as a sapling when Jesus was born, is truly awesome in my mind.
Yeah. They're unlike even perennials in our gardens. Yeah. Trees last a long time, and when they fall for some reason, it seems a huge tragedy. My mother wrote me about this big storm that was in the Boundary Waters early in the month. She said, and 10 by 40 mile swath of all the trees wiped out. No, just gone.
This is northern Minnesota.
Yeah.
You don't know Boundary Waters.
Mount St. Helens. Toothpicks.
Yeah.
Toothpicks.
I remember going through the Yellowstone fire. We were in the fire and then we went up again. Well, I mean that. Well, we actually drove up into it, so we didn't want to go. But part of the tree thing was, for me, was the lodgepole pine, which are all over Yellowstone. And I grew up with the only way that they can reproduce is through fire. Mm-hmm. So this, you know, they open up under that intense heat. It's a little bit different notion of tree of life, you know, burning to sort of replenish it. And then the growth that next comes after was just
so lush.
Yeah.
We have a huge oak tree in our backyard, and the, you know, diameter is, well, very large. I often wonder how old that tree must be, a couple hundred years maybe, I don't know. But I've always envisioned it as a source of shelter. And hopefully that there will be no strong wind that would ever blow it on the house.
Yeah, and this is one of the important things. I'm going to read a little bit from Gail Ramshaw's, her reflections about the tree of life. But when we use a tree as a symbol, it becomes a metaphor. And one of the important things about a metaphor is the way it's both like and unlike what it's pointing to. And also, if we have metaphors to talk about religious matters, we probably need metaphors that have that multivalence, that can have both. It gives me shelter, and it could fall on me, right? So that the if you walk out on the nature trail, you'll see several places where I think they call them nursery trees.
Yeah.
You know, where this big old cedar has fallen down, and there's a little cedar growing up out of the downed trunk. So that there's the beauty of the tree, and then there's the terror of the elm in the storm. Right? There's being concealed in the climbing tree and then being lost in the tree. Right? All of that mixes together and allows us to see beyond the tree. Right? So that the tree of life doesn't become some kind of fetish. Although, no, I've broken the clasp on it. Unfortunately, I have a pin that's the tree of life that I've been wearing for months and months. Someone sent it to me for a present. And I admit, it gets to be a little bit of a fetish. I put my hand on it. You know, something goes badly, and I think, okay, tree of life. Calm down. Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, knock on wood. There you go. Gail Ramshaw, in a couple of her works, has written about the tree of life. First of all, she wrote about it in this book, God Beyond Gender, Feminist Christian God Language. And then later, she expanded that to write a kind of autobiographical piece called Under the Tree of Life, The Religion of a Feminist Christian. And I want to read it, which we have many copies of in the bookstore. And even if we didn't, I would urge you to look for it somewhere else, because I found it a very lively account of one woman's attempt to actually, what Anne was talking about yesterday, to improvise and to say, here are the cords of my tradition that really provide for me the firm base. Now maybe I've mixed my metaphor, so that doesn't make sense anymore, but here's the parts I can sing. And she also talks about the parts she can't sing and what happens with that. Well, here's what one of the things she writes about in this section called Especially the Ubiquitous Tree of Life. The tree itself enthralled me, sending me hiking over the centuries into many Christian cultures and throughout other religions, and I have seen trees everywhere. And I expect this will happen to you when you go home. Having thought about the tree of life, you're going to see it everywhere. Both because that's what happens, you know, if you buy a new car, then suddenly everybody has a blue, whatever it is you buy. But also because this is an image that is really gaining a kind of purchase on our imagination. It seems well suited to our times. I treasure Pennsylvania's autumn colors. I have stood under California's redwoods. I read about the cedar, the tree of life for Canada's northwest coast, native people, and over our mantle is an Aboriginal painting of the Pendanus palm, the tree of life in Australia's northern territories. In Sweden, among all those Bronze Age rock carvings of phallic warriors spearing animals, we found a prehistoric evergreen tree engraved next to a monstrous beast. When in Britain a millennium ago, Saxon masons constructed stone churches for the Normans, they carved a tree over the doorway of one church after another. In Rome, at the garden cluster of St. Paul's outside the wall, each stone column is carved to represent a unique tree. Our collection includes tree rugs and mugs, tree prints and plates, tree sweaters and aprons, tree pendants and earrings. One friend calls our home the Grove. And of course, this is also what happens to, you know, Garrison Keillor, is that funny little thing about, you say, somebody gives you a rooster and you think, oh, this is nice, so you put it out, and then everyone gets, pretty soon you have a whole house full of roosters. Probably better the tree of life than a rooster. And when at a hotel thousands of miles from Philadelphia, I entered our room and saw a print of a man climbing down a tree to greet a woman sitting underneath, and I knew I was home. But natural trees, even moss-adorned temperate rainforests that pulsate with vibrant greens and grow in your mind forever after, are like me, only alive for a while. You live for a while and then you die. Thus, many trees of life reach toward the supernatural. A Currier and Ives heavenly tree with each fruit labeled as one of the virtues. A Mexican tree candelabra with naked Eve and Adam still happily surrounded with leaves and flowers. A yarn painting depicting the Hacholi's vision-granting peyote tree. I think of the Buddha's Bodhi tree of enlightenment, a fig tree the same as Augustine's, the four plant stock with corn, maize, squash, and tobacco all in one on the Navajo sand paintings, the burning bush that Marc Chagall created for Christian church windows. Indeed, although the cross with a bleeding Christ was all I had been taught, the church as a whole knew better. And though a stranger saw a dead man on a pole, the believer saw a magnificent, mysterious tree with 12 fruits, different each month, and with all the birds of the air finding nest in the crossbeam. And then she says, tells you some other places you could go to see trees. Poets remind us that the deepest images, the sea, the mountain, the monsoon, a woman's womb, signify both life and death. And so I need both, the tree and the cross. And only as both can either one be hardy enough to stand. The cross by itself can become an icon to death, an acceptance of helplessness before the abyss, a picture of only the Buddha's first noble truth that life is suffering with no eightfold path as solution. However, the tree by itself can be a romantic dream. The fantasy of Mother Nature protects us and gives us happiness. Okay. So Ramshaw, having looked at all of that, really recommends to us this tree of life to enrich our image of God. And she says we need it in part to break our graven images, our images that have become dead, that don't carry the life anymore. The tree of life has that. She says in part it restores our respect for creation, it connects us with other traditions, and then this multivalence. The ability to be both shelter and danger, to both be beautiful and to give us a vision of something quite frightening. So she says, Christian hope is that the tree of death always among us can become a tree of life, that we have to have both. There's also a long tradition of this in Christianity, and Ramshaw points out, for example, that Tertullian, not one of my favorite theologians, but certainly one of the most quotable, uses the image of the tree to talk about the Trinity. I know, it's stunning. Every time Tertullian says something useful, I have to break my image and say, well, he was a weird guy, and I don't want to be by him in heaven, but... Once in a while, he had something useful to say, and he talks about the Trinity as the root, the tree, and the fruit. Really pointing us then, I think, to the way Paul in Galatians talks about the fruits of the Spirit. A couple other things about trees I want to say that to lead us into then this session when we're going to look at the fruits of the tree. Rather than focusing entirely on the millennial business and the tree of life as some other age, to talk about, well, if we're living under this tree in our front yard or our backyard or in our national park or where someplace close and accessible to us, then what are those fruits? What does it mean to live under this tree? The growth and death of trees points us to the passing of seasons, to time passing, to that sense of chronology. Dave Christian, who was here last week and I were talking about this, he recalled going back to last fall to visit his college campus at Valparaiso University, and he said, you know, the trees around the chapel had grown in 20 years, and the chapel looked different with those big trees. We can sense the passing of time, even with evergreens, these two big trees out here by where we wait for the bus. I was watching my son climb way up to the top and thinking, you know, a few years ago, those were too wobbly for children. And now they're there, an ever-present danger and attraction. So we see that changing of time, the seasons of flowering and bearing fruit, and then a season of fallowness, even for an evergreen, although it doesn't lose its boundaries. So I want us to think both about that chronological time and then the sense of anticipation, because the image in Revelation really does point to a new age, not to this age, right? It's this new thing. Apocalyptic literature is very interested in eschatology, the end time, not the time we're in, but some later time. So I'm going to appropriate that image of the tree of life and say, well and good, an end time, a new Jerusalem, but what about now? To a greater or lesser degree, of course, all Christians are always living in anticipation. We're in this between time, between when Jesus was here and when Jesus comes back. We're waiting for that return, but with more or less urgency, right? Some Christians seem really to be expecting that any moment. Some communities seem to expect that any moment. Barb read to us this morning from Hal Lindsey, and his sense, you know, this is the burning question of our age. And I remember when I was in high school, sort of in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a lot of that. Oh, will I see you again? The end of the world may come before I see you again. It seemed really very present. What I want us to do today is look at two responses to this living in the meantime, I call it. Okay. One is the early church, particularly as we see it in a document called the Didache. And the second are the Shakers, also known as the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Coming. So we don't leave behind entirely the millennial expectation of the end times, what the book of Revelation is in part about, but rather to focus more on how a community lives as it's waiting. Okay, does that make sense? And I hope as we do that, you'll keep in mind these questions that if I don't digress too much, we'll have time to talk a little bit about at the end. What do Christians today have in common that makes us a community under this tree? That's not spelled right, is it?
U-C.
C somewhere. Wow.
Before the T.
Thank you. My students are always snickering at me because spelling is not one of my best things. And there's no spell check on the chalkboard. Okay, so what do we have in common that unites us as we wait under this tree? And what characterizes our life? There are different kinds of trees, right? What is life like under this tree? What are the kinds of fruits that we eat? Or, as symbols often do, if it slips, and suddenly we're not living under the tree, but we are the tree, what kind of fruit do we bear? Okay. How will we organize this life under the tree? This becomes really important as we wait. Okay. I talk about this often with my students as the Gilligan's Island phenomena. Right? You go out for a 3-hour tour, and you land on the beach, and at first you think, oh, well, somebody will come soon. We don't really need to get organized. But then it's night. And one night you can sleep on the beach. But a week it gets old, and then how are we going to get food? And what if the monsoons come? And even though you're still hoping somebody's going to come and rescue you, you got to do something in the meantime. right? How are we going to organize this life? And then what unites us across time? Because this waiting takes more than one generation, right? Paul writes, some will not pass away before this comes, but some have, right? Some definitely have. And as a historian, I'm particularly interested in time. That's what historians are, how we organize everything is across time, what changes and what endures. So I want to look at these two communities, but first, a short digression about the word community. I'm drawing a little bit here on a lecture I did at Concordia College a couple years ago called Living in the Meantime, Lessons from Christians Living in Community. And it's often the case once you pick a title that you think, oh, well, what did I mean by that title? So I had recourse to the Unabridged Dictionary because I wanted to say something about the etymology of the word community. The first syllable, the kara part, right, is really easy because that's like common, we know. It's what you have together. And so I thought, well, the next syllable, this part, must be what you have together. What could that mean? What about that word? So I get out the Unabridged Dictionary, and I'm there studying, and I found three English cognates. They are munificent, right? Someone who is generous. Municipal and munitions. And I could figure, I'm staring at that little print, trying to figure out if this was the same root. And it kind of looked like the first two definitely had the same root, munificent and municipal. But I couldn't tell about this munitions business, which seemed kind of weird. No, and so I called my colleague in the classics department, Jim, would you help me out here so I could hear the pages? He's looking here, he's looking there, and he said, you know, Deanna, I'm sorry to tell you, we can't tell which is the proper root. Which one is it, munitions or municipal in community? It's unclear. So then I get up to give this talk at Concordia, and there's Olin Starvik, that classics faculty member, distinguished, venerable. And so I, of course, put this all on Jim May. I asked Jim May, and this is what he told me. And Olin went home and looked and looked and looked, and he came back and he said, there might be a Sanskrit root behind those two, and if so, it's clearly the same one. All of which was exactly what I wanted to hear. So nice that the etymology supported the point I wanted to make, namely that the nature of community depends all on what you have in common. And you can have a community that is based on a common gift, a munificent community. You can have a community that's based on common obligations, a municipal community. Or you can have a community that's really a community of munitions or common fortifications. That's what that word is about, having walls, right? Having a common wall. And which you have, and in what proportion, will really determine what kind of community you have. So here, if we can, again, shift a little bit, what kind of tree you live under? What kind of tree gives you shelter? What kind of tree feeds you? No, if you only eat apples, do you end up with rosy cheeks? I don't know. If you only eat pineapples, do you get prickly? We probably don't want to go that route too far because it becomes too literal. So let's look at two examples of, quite briefly actually, two examples of Christian communities who are in some way anticipating a new time, but living in the time they're in. So the first is the early church, and those of you who have been listening to Barbara know, or you know from other sources, that the early church is really no golden age. And I want to be really clear about that. I don't have us look back to the early church like, oh, now there's the blueprint. Now, if we could only get back to the way they did it in Corinth, everything would be fine. Because clearly everything was not fine in Corinth or Ephesus, when you just have to read the Pauline epistles to realize that they were, as we might say, making it up as they went along.
It's got to be Philippi. It seems to be.
Oh, maybe it was better than Philippi. I think Philippi probably. Right. They were making it up. Or to say, to use Anne's vocabulary, they were improvising. Right. And they had, and I think, like the people on Gilligan's Island, that need to improvise intensifies as the delay of Christ's return extends. Now, most of us have read those letters, the Pauline letters and so forth, so we're kind of familiar with that variety between place to place. And a little bit you can see there of change over time. But today I want to talk about another document, which I left at home, so I can't read to you from it. It's called the Didache, or the Teaching of the 12 Apostles. And this is a little bit like a message in a bottle, because the Didache was lost for centuries and then rediscovered or recovered by a scholar in the late 1800s. It's a little document in an English translation with footnotes. It's about 10 pages long. Okay, so I almost tried to get someone to fax it to me. Oh, I've got to have it. Well, we'll just wing it. It gives us a glimpse of a community in transition as it moves into being here for the long haul. I think that's one of the ways to read it. Now, which community isn't clear, because it's a text without a context. We don't know where it came from exactly. It's like, you know, you buy a new house, you find somebody's diary up in the attic, and you're trying to figure out whose was it? And what is this trip that's being narrated here? Scholars have spent lots more than 10 pages trying to decide where the Didache is from. And nowadays, most people think it's probably from Syria, although it might be from Alexandria, or parts of it might be from Alexandria. And it's probably from the second century, although some people think it might be the early first century. Okay? That's not our purpose today, to try and settle that. What we want to do instead is look at this kind of handbook. That would be one way to describe it. It's a little handbook. How to be a Christian. How to have a Christian community. It's organized in two parts, very clearly. The first part, the first section, is the way of life and the way of death. And then the second section is about church order. So, to go to my questions, the first part, what characterizes our life? Here they're writing about the way of life, which does not equal the way of death. It's very different. Two very distinct ways of living. It's grounded in Jesus' response to the Pharisee about what is the greatest commandment. That's how the thing starts out, that you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your neighbor as yourself, and makes direct reference both to that gospel admonition and back to Leviticus, where that came from. And then what follows is this long list of prohibitions and commandments. Okay, so love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your strength, and your neighbor as yourself, and do these things and don't do those things. It's just very clear. And you're thinking, oh, well, what holds this community together is clearly rules and obligations and a quest for perfection. And I'm thinking, I can't do this. This is terrible. This is suffocating. How could they possibly live like this? What's this way of life business? No, that sounds like the way of death to me. And then you come in chapter 6 to this little verse. If you can bear the Lord's full yoke, you will be perfect. But if you cannot, then do what you can. Oh, And so I think when I read that back, start with this admonition to love God. And know that if I can bear the full yoke, I'll be perfect. But if I can't do what I can, then all those prohibitions and rules take on a different tone. And they, instead of telling me what to do, they really give me a lot of questions. They give us, or they give those people, maybe is what we should say. Suddenly there's a lot of discernment and taking responsibility that's necessary for living under this tree, right? The second section of this book, as I said, is about church order, and it too has kind of two sections. The first part is about leadership, and the second part is about worship. Okay, so if the way we're living is a way of life, which is rooted in love of God and neighbor, how do we make that happen? If we have this responsibility to discern and to decide, what can I do, right? Because that, and if you can't do the whole thing, do what you can, how do you know? Right? Have I tried hard enough? How do you discern that? Well, leadership is an important part of that. And one of the things I find fascinating about this book is that you see here the transition from one kind of leadership to another. And as a student of social organizations, I've seen this happen in organizations I've been involved in. Very similar kind of shift. When I was in seminary, I worked as a volunteer at a battered women's shelter that had started out, as many of those kinds of organizations did, as totally volunteer, run by people who were driven or called to this difficult and important, urgent work. And so they were there all hours of the day and night. It was their whole life. And on the days the inspector came, of course, everything was fine so that you met code. And then the rest of the time, if somebody calls and they need a place and you don't have a bed, well, then you find them a piece of floor. No, you just make it work. And as I was there, we moved, we call it in social history, professionalization. We saw that coming, that it was a new director who came from another city who had credentials, right? And who had to raise the money to keep the thing going so that you could build a bigger space so that the next time you didn't have to give someone a piece of floor, but you had a bed. We see that happen over and over and over. And some of that's going on in the Didache. That there's a shift from what Max Weber calls charismatic leadership to official leadership, right? Leadership that is a gift, spiritual gift, and in the Didache, this is identified with prophets, apostles, and teachers. They're usually itinerant. They come wandering in, and you have to test them. Ah, so this is a nice connection back to how do you know what you can do. You have to test them. And then, if they are of the Spirit, right, there's more of this, the way of life and the way of death. Not every leader is a good leader. Not everyone who claims the Spirit has the Spirit. Now, Barb was talking about that this morning in a similar kind of issue in the book of Revelation. What if you disagree? How do you disagree? Well, at least in the Didache, we don't have rules for how to disagree, but we do have this notion that you test the leaders, especially the ones who come claiming a spiritual gift, and then if they're good, they can stay a few days. Right? One of the ways you can tell that they're false is that they hang around too long. But if they're good, while they're there, you should support them. And that includes paying them or feeding them. So that there's a real sense that this way of life, is, even if it depends on the Spirit, it's not only about spiritual things. There's a pragmatic, mundane quality to living under this tree. Right? Yeah.
Actually, that was the other word I thought of for mundane was mundane.
Oh, yeah, good.
Mundo in Spanish.
Yeah, the mundane. which has to do with this world or ordinary or everyday. Yeah, that's, yeah, that adds another layer. Really good. But what then what they see happening is there are also in here instructions for how you elect deacons and bishops who are local leaders. So rather, it's nice. It's nice if there's a windfall of apples, but how do you make sure that every year you're going to have apples? How do you make sure that there will be leaders? So there are these instructions about electing deacons and bishops, which I think is another kind of testing. But it's for a different kind of leadership because they will stay in the same place. They're local and they're stationary. And that's a different kind of community than... I think there's a parallel in American history when Frederick Jackson Turner says the frontier is closed. Right? There's no more, well, if this doesn't work, we can always move west. Right? And maybe we have that in the ecological realm. We've suddenly realized you can't always just move to a new place. The earth is only this big. And one last thing about this leadership in the didache business. The people are admonished to give the same honor to the elected deacons and bishops that they would have given to the prophets, apostles, and teachers. Now clearly, this is one of the things we do when we read these kind of documents. You only admonish people to do things that they're not doing, right? This was a problem. But don't we know this? It's that saying about a prophet is not without honor except in their own country. The local people who are with you day by day, it's a lot easier to see all their warts, the ways in which they cannot bear the whole yoke of the Lord. That's one of the issues that we have as we live under this tree. Waiting, but trying to wait in a way that is consistent with what we hope for. Okay, then one last category is worship. If you were to read the Didache, if I had not brought the wrong collection of documents, and I had it here for you, I would read to you some of the instructions about worship, and this would be the part that would be most familiar. The instructions about how to conduct baptism, the discussion about the Eucharist, the use of the Lord's Prayer, and these words about the grains of wheat scattered on the hill that are gathered into one, right? Which have become very familiar to us in the last years in the Eucharistic liturgy. We hear that. So to come to this question about what unites us across time, when you look at the Didache, there are some real clear things. One, which I haven't highlighted too much, is the scripture. Although these people are chronologically much closer to Jesus than we are, they are like us in that their access to Jesus is through the witness of others, including through the scriptures. And the scholars have gone through and picked out those little fragments of scripture and identified them, and it just peppers the whole of the book. So one of the things we have in common across time and in our own time, of course, is the scripture. A second is, of course, these sacraments, baptism and the Eucharist. So that central act, which anticipates a new time, is something that we have in common. Oh, and the Lord's Prayer is also embedded here. So these may become some of the chords we improvise from, right? These are the things we have in common. Now,
I think even there, though, the interesting thing about the Didache description of the Eucharist is the cup is first, and then
yeah.
bread. So it's giving
yeah,
very
nice.
Specific instructions about how to do it, but it's different
right.
from what Paul says in 1 Corinthians.
Right.
It goes to show the
yeah.
variety.
Yeah, very good.
You know, you got bread and the cup, but you do them in a different order.
Right, right. And you don't know what this bread is like. And that's one of the things the scholars are trying to figure out where it's from, is this business on the hill. One place, other internal evidence makes you think it's from, there are hills with grain on it. So how did that get in there? How did somebody go to a retreat community and they got that and they thought it was really nice, so they brought it back to their community? I mean, really, in Southern California, you see grains of wheat scattered on the hill. When was the last time you saw a grain field in Southern California? Okay, now, a very different community is this United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Coming. And their view of this coming time is quite different, because the Shakers, as they were at first derisively and now just neutrally called, believed that Christ had come again. That Christ had been reincarnated in Mother Ann Lee, even as Christ had been incarnated earlier in Jesus. Okay, so they thought this had already come. They're not anticipating another return, but having had that return already, they have to figure out, well, what does that mean for the way we live? And they're a fascinating group in whom lots of people are interested. And you could spend days and days and days talking about them, and I only want to quickly point to some of the characteristics that might respond to these questions. As I said, they believe that Christ had already come again in the person of Mother Ann Lee, and that this ushered in a new dispensation of regeneration and perfection. Okay, so that now that Christ has come, we have a new era with new life, and there will be a kind of perfection. If you'd like to read about this and you're ready to read a big book, Stephen Stein's book, The Shaker Experience in America, is probably the best. But it is, like this. But it's really good. And one of the things Stein does is posit five phases in the history of this movement. Now, people, when you talk about the Shakers, they sort of go, oh, they were celibate, right? So no surprise, they didn't last very long. But just look at this. They lasted from the 1740s into the late 1900s. So 200 plus years.
So you're aware there's Shaker influences in the Native American communities out of the Olympic Peninsula.
Really? Yeah.
They're still...
Yeah, they closed the covenant in the 1960s. So after the 1960s, nobody knew could join. But that's a really long, it wasn't 1,000 years, right? So you might have expected, if you've been reading a certain kind of millennialism, that from Mother Ann Lee there should be 1,000 years. But they didn't last 1,000, but they lasted over 200. And what is this group? It is a celibate, millenarian sect, which gathered in socialist communities. Its origins were in England in the early industrial mid-1700s. That same ferment of religion out of which the Puritans and the Pilgrims come. Okay, it's that same time period, just before the American Revolution. And it belongs to a type of radical reform called spiritualist. So it's not the Quakers, even though the names sound kind of the same and there are some similar characteristics. It's not the Amish, even though there are some similarities. That's because they're all part of this big group called radical reform. And with the Shakers, the Shakers are a subtype of that called spiritualists. That means, very simply, that they rely on the spirit over text or office. Okay, so that the spirit is the primary authority for everything. And here, one of the reasons I think the Shakers are important, as we think in our own time about being Christian people, is that although you can make an argument pretty easily that the Shakers went beyond Christianity, this emphasis on the spirit is very, very prevalent in American Christianity. It's the underlying theme of what unites a lot of American Christianity. And that's good, and it's dangerous. And so the Shakers may help us think about what's good about it and what's dangerous about it. They came, immigrated here in 1744, Mother Anne Lee and some of her followers. She was a relatively uneducated woman whose previous life was not entirely happy and was certainly marred by very unhappy experiences with reproduction. Okay, yeah.
You said they're celibate?
Yes.
How did they last 200 years?
I'm coming to that. Can you wait?
Did they live that long?
No, they did not live. That's a very interesting suggestion. Celibacy contributing to longevity. No. The first village was gathered in the 1780s, so pre-revolutionary. But most of that pre-revolutionary period, they were a very small group. They would travel around New England preaching, and they were opposed, in part because they were pacifists. So as the revolution begins to stir up, the fact that they were non-resistant gave them the sense of being treasonous. So again, there are these interesting ways in which the Book of Revelation, although it's not our point, kind of skirts around the edge. We will not give allegiance to the government. And until the Civil War, what they did was buy that off. They would pay for somebody else, but they always paid taxes on all their property. They refused to take the tax benefit. Okay. They really grow in the 19th century. This coincides with the period of the Great Awakening and Revivalism, when there is a great outpouring of spiritual energy in the United States, and the camp meetings and the Finneyite Revival, and the same time as a lot of utopian experiments, Brook Farm, the Oneida Community, Fruitland, all of these utopian groups trying to figure out how to bring, if you will, the kingdom of God to earth, right? Instead of waiting for that to happen, we'll just figure that out here, right? And that's a long tradition in American history. At the height of the movement in the mid-1800s, they had 19 villages spread up and down the eastern seaboard, which were organized communally into families. There would be the church family in the center, and the north family, and the east and the west, and the south family. These families were not a nuclear family. They were more like Jesus's admonition that whoever does the will of God is my mother and my sister and my brother. Everyone was a convert. Okay, everyone is a convert. You aren't born into it. Families would join as a whole, and you could sort of start out on the periphery, but if you're going to be in the church family, then you've given up that marital relationship. The children are sort of as in a kibbutz. They live in their own house, the girls' house and the boys' house. The boys had school in the winter and then worked on the farm in the summer, and the girls had school in the summer. Everyone had their work to do. At the height, there were about 6,000 members, and they were busy developing teaching and practice. In the 1840s and 50s was this time called Mother Anne's Work. She'd long since died, but there was heightened spiritual activity, including the spirit drawings. Some of you may have seen these spirit drawings. And in fact, Ramshaw's interest in the Tree of Life comes from a very famous spirit drawing. And you see it reproduced all over, the green tree with the little orange fruits. Right, that's a Shaker spirit drawing that has entered into the public domain, so you can get rubber stamps, postcards, Christmas cards, everything. Okay, so, and then by the 1870s, there's increased accommodation to the world and the closing of the covenant in the 1960s. Now, what everybody knows about the Shakers, one, furniture, right? In fact, one of the last Shaker sisters who lived at Canterbury said, "I'm a little afraid I'm going to be remembered as a chair." Although, by the 1900s, the Shakers weren't making that furniture anymore. They were buying furniture. They painted their rooms different colors. But the furniture, I think, points to one thing about the Shakers that's important for us, yikes, as we think about what characterizes our life, and that's their notion of work and how one uses material things. Some little aphorisms. from the Shakers, hands to work and heart to God, is one you hear a lot. That when you go to make a broom, one of the things the Shakers invented is the flat broom, right? When you go to make a broom, it's an act of worship. A thing well made is a prayer, is another Shaker aphorism. So this sense of, as Jim said, the mundane. That what we do in our ordinary day-to-day life, how you make a window, matters. And if any of you visited any of the Shaker villages that are now open as museums, it's well, well worth it. And on the one I visited, the kitchen is always on the lower level, sort of half in the ground, and the window frames go like this, so that the light is reflected in. Right? They're very careful about all those little details. The barns arranged in such a way that the hay falls easily down to the cows and that the manure falls down to where it needs to be. Using gravity, working with the material things. And Mother Anne admonished her followers, do all your work as if you had 1,000 years to live and as if you would die tomorrow. So a really interesting way of thinking about that millennium, do it to last 1,000 years. There's the picket fence around the meeting house at the Canterbury community. Those same pickets have been there 200 years or more because they put little granite blocks in the dirt this much up and then the picket on the top. So it didn't rot, right? So that kind, but, and as if you would die tomorrow, kind of open-handedness, celibacy. This is related, it's a kind of perfection, and it's related to the Shaker's view that sex is the origin of original sin. Okay, so they have this view of sexuality and reproductive sexuality as sin. Then, out of that, they develop this incredible understanding of gender balance. So you keep everything in balance. What is this new era of regeneration and perfection? It requires a balance. So you see it in the buildings. Every building has two entries. The sisters go in one door and the brothers go in the other door, right? Everything is balanced. The marches that were part of worship during Mother Anne's work, it's all balanced. The whole leadership structure is organized with that balance. So in each community, there are eldresses and elders, deacons and deaconesses who do the internal, the elders and eldresses do the spiritual leadership. The deacons are concerned with internal matters of finance, etc. And then the trustees, only these were called the trustees and the office sisters, dealt with the world, but always balanced. And it was one of the real crises as the membership began to go down in the 1900s is the loss of balance because there were only sisters and no brothers. And it didn't, the other thing I want to say about that, it didn't change their work roles. The sisters worked in the kitchen, the brothers worked in the farm. Okay, this meant, how do you last over 200 years when you're celibate? It's all recruitment. It's all recruitment. One of the works they did was that they ran essentially orphanages and schools. So a lot of young children were brought to the Shakers for a wide range of reasons. This little book that came out about a year ago, Simple Gifts, Lessons in Living from a Shaker Village, is written by a woman who, you know, it's the introduction, I was a teenage Shaker. In the summer of 1972, when she had just finished her first year of college, she went and lived in the Canterbury community, which then had about 8 Shakers, and worked as a tour guide. But she lived in the community with these women and then maintained for 20 years relationships with those women. She tells lots of stories in here about how those women came to be Shakers and how the Shakers that these women had known as children had become to be Shakers. And, you know, some of them are heart-rending. You know, my father got remarried and the new wife didn't like me, and so they took me to the Shakers, or orphans, or all different ways. But as Spriggs says, the community only existed because one member at a time chose to stay. Now, I think we may not buy this celibacy business, and we may not buy the perfection business, and we may not buy the communal economic business, but this, the community only existed because one member at a time chose to stay, is very, I think, challenging for us as we think about what is it that we have in common? Would you choose to keep it? Do you stay because of what's really important, or do you stay for peripheral reasons? Certainly the Shakers had people who stayed for peripheral reasons, and they even called them winter Shakers. You know, they were prosperous. They said that if you drove along a road and then you came to the Shaker village, which was usually on both sides of a road, the road got better. Now I know in rural Iowa this happens, you can go from one county to the other. And you can tell which county cares about its roads, because instead of going like this, suddenly it's smooth. Same thing. The Shaker Road, suddenly it was smooth. They had food. They were very prosperous. And people would come for those reasons. But others came because they really wanted to be there. And then we also know about the Shakers, their worship and their songs. "'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free, 'tis a gift to come down where we ought to be." That came out of Mother Ann's work too. One of the Shakers was given that. So, oh dear, I've digressed far too much because there's no time left to think about how those two communities might affect the way we think about living under our tree. I think certainly they offer us some challenges. Perfection. It's easy to say, oh, we aren't perfect. God doesn't expect us to be perfect. And my son has learned to say this to me when I say to someone, oh, yeah, that's perfect. He goes, Mom, nothing's perfect. Because he's heard me say it so many times. And I assert that my understanding of grace allows us not to be bound by the quest for perfection. And yet, there's something about that desire that a thing well made is a prayer. Right? To always think of what can we give that's the first fruits. Okay? What's the first fruit? I think that's one of the challenges. We maybe can pick and choose about these organizational matters, but it's clear that we need to think about them. Right? How does money come in? How does work come in? And then how do we make use of these things we have common in Christ across time? So people have things they were just burning to say, and I didn't let you say. We have about a couple minutes. You have our...
Well, I was just going to say one more tree thing that sort of ties in. I remember when I was at Yale Divinity School, we had three of the Shakers who were still alive there in the 70s come down and speak to us, and they taught us some songs, and one of them was about a tree. And it was interesting that they were much more drawn to the image of the willow tree than the oak. In fact,
interesting.
The community. And this one song, I think I can remember, it goes like, I will not be like the stubborn oak, but I will be like the willow tree.
Yeah.
I'll bow and bend unto God's will, and I will seek God's mercy still. Yeah. And they really wanted the willow to be their image of how we're supposed to be like trees. And it was really interesting when they would describe what the beauty of the willow tree was as compared to the stubborn oak.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the lone...
Right, and then I hadn't thought of this before, but also the use of wood in the Shaker crafts, and that always the concern to show it beautifully, you know, and to make it do form-following function, which we think of as, you know, a quintessentially American aesthetic. But that was very much part of the Quaker worldview, that you make it do its work, but it's also beautiful. And then you adapt. And that's one of the things that's fascinating about this book, is the sort of adaptations that these people made. They were not Luddites. Right? They didn't say, oh, well, no electric stove. And in fact, she tells a little anecdote in here about Bertha, who was at this time an eldress, but had been in, when she was 13 or 14, was in charge of making the pies. She would make 30 pies on one day to last the whole week. And they said, Bertha, tell us your pie recipe. And she went to the refrigerator and got out this Betty Crocker pre-made pie stick. And she said, this is as good as what I can make. And it saves time. Now, if it wasn't as good as what she could make, then she wouldn't have used it. But she was willing to make those adaptations to be like a willow, not an oak, that perfection is not getting it right forever and always, but paying attention to where you're planted, maybe, you know. You can't have a palm tree at Holden Village. It's just not going to work.
And something else I think about the Shakers, they were well known for a huge number of inventions compared
right.
to any other religious
right.
community, like 200
yeah.
original inventions. And I think part of that is redirecting their energies. You know, the celibacy and taking care of organizational things yeah. allowed them, freed them up to think about quality and life being a prayer every
yeah.
act.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, the other thing is, Ken Burns got his start as a documentary maker, making a documentary on the Shakers. So if you ever have a chance to see it, it's really quite fun. Yeah.
You know, the other thing I think, Leanne, is as challenging for me, I think many of us, as any of the particulars of this, is just simply the idea of intentional community.
Right.
So much of our lives just goes against that grain. And so mm-hmm. we kind of dip into a church community or a work community or a mm-hmm. neighborhood community, but we don't really have a real intentional community that governs it like these two
mm-hmm.
examples.
And we know more about how that worked for the Shakers than we do
yeah.
for whoever it was that the Didache was for.
Yeah.
But the Shakers really can be a challenge to us in that way, to the focus and the discipline of it. And knowing that, I love that definition of community that Parker Palmer gives about community is where when the person you like the least leaves, someone just like them will come and take their place. And how do you learn to live with that in a way that's generous? So, we need to stop.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.